This week on the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast, Ashley Canty joins us for a conversation about the importance of diversity within chapters.
It's very beneficial to the development of the student in that it provides them a way to not only challenge what it is that they know, but also to provide some perspective and challenge for other people so that then they can begin to critically think about the world around them in ways that they're able to form an opinion of how the world affects them, but also their effects on the world.
And the role that advisors can play in emphasizing diversity and inclusion.
The advisors have to be conscious of the biases we bring to the job. How we reflect what we think and believe onto students and their experience can definitely set the tone on how our students view us, this, how they view themselves, and how they view the community.
Hello, and welcome to the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast. I'm your host, Matt Deeg, and this week we're continuing our focus on diversity and inclusion within fraternity and sorority life. It's kind of a chaotic week here outside the show, so I'm going to get right to our interview with Ashley Canty. I'm so thankful she took the time, twice in fact, to chat with me about diversity within our fraternal organizations and communities. You all told me that you wanted to hear from her, and I took your feedback into account, and so continue to reach out to me with guests that you think would be wonderful on the show. Tweet at me, at Matt Deeg, or hit me up on Facebook. And now, our guest for the week. Ashley Canty serves as the Director of Diversity and Inclusion for Sigma Alpha Epsilon. She is a member of Zeta Phi Beta Sorority, Incorporated. She holds a Master's of Science in College Student Personnel from Western Illinois University and is currently a doctoral candidate at DePaul University. Prior to beginning her work with SAE, Ashley worked at Syracuse and DePaul Universities in their Fraternity Sorority Life offices. I reached out to Ashley thanks to some of your suggestions, and here's our conversation. Hey, Ashley, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for joining me. Full disclosure for our listeners, Ashley was a trooper, and we chatted, and then my computer ate all of our recording, and so she's being a real trooper and sharer and going one more time so we can actually get this information out to y'all. So big props to you, Ashley, and thanks for jumping in, I guess, again with me on this. So, well, I want to start our conversation by kind of framing it. You know, conversations that I've seen on the FSL knowledge community and some other things let me know that this is a pretty relevant topic, this idea of diversity and inclusion within our organizations. And so, you know, I think most of our conversation today is going to focus in on some of the, you know, racial diversity within our organizations, but really that's just part of a broader conversation around diversity and inclusion. And when we talk about those organizations, you know, we're going to focus mostly on what we would call those typically white fraternal organizations, member groups within the NIC and NPC. And I think, you know, many of our listeners who know some of their fraternal history, and you'll, I'm sure you'll share some of this too, but know that these groups were founded at a time when diversity wasn't really present on a college campus. But as our campuses increased in their diversity, a lot of those groups kind of didn't follow suit, and they stayed kind of in that predominantly white category. And so I wanted to just start off with just some thoughts about, like, what are some of the driving factors behind, one, just the rise in diversity on campuses, but two, the you know, the reticence or just the not increasing or staying with the diversity amongst many of our ISC and Panhellenic orgs.
So I think that a lot of times the lack of diversity is often due to, you know, the students don't want, maybe don't see anything wrong with it, or they're like, oh, like, we are diverse, we have this many members or whatnot. I think it's important for them to think about diversity in a broader sense, more than just race, but thinking about, you know, how are you expanding your networks? Where are you getting members from? Or how are you engaging on campus? And how are you meeting people who can bring something to the chapter? I think that a chapter that is diverse in perspective and background is very beneficial to the development of the student in that it provides them a way to not only challenge what it is that they know, but also to provide some perspective and challenge for other people so that then they can begin to critically think about the world around them in ways that they're able to form an opinion of how the world affects them, but also their effects on the world around them. Similar to, you know, introducing new ideas of thinking. I think there's always resistance and people being defensive when they hear we're not diverse, we're not inclusive. But I think it really is one of those things that we should use as a challenge to think about who are our members, where are our members from, and in cases where we are a diverse and inclusive group, really understanding what that means in the terms of making sure that just because we're diverse, that we're also being inclusive to understanding different backgrounds and perspectives of the students and members that are in our organization.
Yeah, would you say that there's a difference between diversity and inclusion? Because I feel like you kind of were alluding to that I could have a wide range of diverse individuals in my chapter, but perhaps still not be inclusive of all of them. What's that difference look like?
So I was on a campus meeting with campus professional. They explained it as we talked, like the diversity is being invited to the party and inclusion is being asked to dance. We're inviting people to our chapters, but we're not asking them to dance in terms of asking them about who they are, where they come from. So, for example, if you have a member who, let's say, doesn't show up to a lot of the evening events, maybe they're a commuter, maybe they work to pay for college or work to pay their dues. A lot of times in my conversations with students, you know, they automatically assume the person doesn't want to be there, or they don't want to bring in people who are commuter students, or they don't want students who have to work a lot. And I think that we miss out on the perspective of a student based on socioeconomic status that does need to work to pay for whatever reason. Maybe, you know, they are in a situation where they have to fund the money, or maybe it's something that they value in doing for themselves. But whatever the situation is, a lot of times that perspective or that idea is not always welcomed in our organizations. And that's just a snapshot of a way that we aren't really inclusive to other populations of students. And I think as much as we know the benefit of being involved for fraternities and sororities, when you are a commuter student or you are a student that maybe works a lot or has different responsibilities, we often don't promote that type of involvement in our types of organizations. Maybe we'll tell them to join something else. But I think there's a value in understanding someone else's experience and what that can bring to the chapter versus looking at what it takes away from the chapter and being able to have that conversation, because we can invite people to join, but I'll be inclusive in understanding their story, their perspective, their background, to be able to understand how the chapter affects them, but also what they bring to the chapter to make it better as well.
Yeah, that conversation about the, you know, the individuals who may have to work part-time or full-time jobs to attend school makes me think about some of the less inclusive practices that might exist within our organizations around like point systems or something, where we recognize like on-campus involvement, but we don't care if you work a job or have a family or do other things outside of the, we'll call it traditional or formerly traditional mainstream way of looking at the college experience. And so, you know, I appreciate kind of your willingness and others' willingness to challenge and say, hey, what are we doing? And I know we're going to touch on some of those other practices that fraternities and sororities have that help keep them from being inclusive and diverse a little bit later. So I want to keep us rolling with kind of this idea of, you know, driving factors, but shifting a little bit to really why diversity is important within our fraternal organizations. I think, you know, maybe touching on some of those reasons for it within chapters, but also within the national groups as well as in the communities as a whole on college campuses. So why is that, you know, important for us to continue to push for in specifically like the ISEs and Panhellenics of the world?
I think it's important because college is changing. The environment, the campus, the culture, the student body looks a lot different now than it might have looked 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that when we talk about fraternities and sororities, we talk about all the benefits it provides, all the great things that we do, and the way that our alumni coming gives back, but we only reserve it for certain people or certain identities, and we're missing out on people that, one, could benefit from the experience, but also we could benefit from their involvement as well. And so in thinking about diversity, you know, it's important for students to have a global perspective. It's important for them to understand what goes on in other places of the world and to be accepting of those practices that maybe they may not agree with or understand, but know that it's important to someone else. You know, we're so connected in this day and age that, you know, students are getting jobs in other countries, and students are working with staff and, you know, companies that are housed in other countries, and they have to know the importance of not only understanding who they are, but having an appreciation for others, and using those connections and those networks that they build, you know, in college to help them understand what it means to have a global perspective. A lot of campuses are forming curriculum around, you know, global citizenship. So what happens in other countries affects us, and what we do here affects them. And really understanding what that means as a fraternity is really someone who joined an organization that is charged to make the world a better place, to give back, you know, to communities that are in need. And also just understanding basically, you know, that our experience isn't always the norm. And I think sometimes we're challenged by that in ways that make us critique or criticize other groups, but really being able to have those conversations across difference as it relates to diversity in the chapter and on the campus is so important as they go on and continue in life, because of how connected we are and how much of the world is joined together by things such as social media, the internet, and jobs and things.
Yeah, you know, I mean, probably 10 years ago or so, right, Thomas Friedman wrote The World is Flat, and he talked about, you know, how we are, just like you said, we're interacting with people from different countries and different cultures on a consistent basis, and that, you know, my economy isn't just in, say, Lawrence, Kansas or Chicago, Illinois, but, you know, I'm working with people all over the globe. And so helping our students to really understand how to do that by exploring and appreciating these differences. And the other thing that I thought of as you were talking about kind of that benefit to both the chapter but also to the individuals is that this is really a mutually beneficial thing, right? There are people who want or need or could benefit from the fraternal experience who, for one reason or another, we don't necessarily have participating in the fraternal experience. And so while we also get that benefit, we can serve as a benefit for them by providing some of those developmental pieces of the fraternal experience. And I think in all of our mission statements and values, we talk about bettering men or bettering women, and we don't say, well, we're going to better this type of person. It's just bettering men or bettering women. And so, you know, that mutually beneficial piece for the individual chapters and their membership is super important. One of the things too, I mean, and I'd love for your thoughts on this, but what about like the entire community within the campus? I know we talked specifically about like in organizations and their individual members, but diversity for the, you know, the Greek community at X State University or whatever.
So I think when we think about the community as a whole, we also have to think about the advisors that work with the community, because I think the advisors can always set the tone or the expectation. You know, I will always believe that student change is the best change, because when students lead change, it often sticks, versus when sometimes advisors make them do things that change them, it doesn't always stick after we leave. And so in thinking about, you know, communities, advisors have to be conscious of the biases we bring to the job. How we reflect what we think and believe onto students and their experience can definitely set the tone on how our students view us, how they view themselves, and how they view the community. And so first we have to work with it within ourselves to figure out our own identity, where we hold privilege, and what that means. And thinking about the community, we also have to think about how we often other the experience of culturally based organizations. So I remember a while back there was a conversation in the NASA group about what do you call recruitment? And so some people were like, well, it's sorority recruitment. And some people pushed back and said, well, does it include culturally based groups? And they're like, no. And it's like, well, language is important. So saying Panhellenic recruitment and ISD recruitment, and, you know, having the councils, culturally based group councils, have events as well that help them to recruit and to bring members to events so that they can learn about them. You know, helping young men and young women understand that there are so many options on the campus that's not limited to the group that they maybe most racially see themselves in. You know, understanding that as a community, that culturally based organizations, NPHC, NALFO, NMGC, NAPRA, and any other umbrella groups, special interest groups, as well as ISD and Panhellenic organizations, can work together provided that advisors and campuses give them the tools to cross that bridge, because while diversity within the organization is important, it's also important for campuses to see these Greek organizations that were founded on very similar principles, working together in ways to make a difference in the community. Because a lot of times when we're doing it separately and we're doing some things over here and we're not connecting, we're missing out on an opportunity to be better as a whole. And I think that when we look at the larger community and we look at the diversity in that, and you look at the men and women in those communities that work together, that sends a message to the campus community about what is expected when you come into these spaces. And that sets the tone for what diversity and inclusion looks like within your fraternity sorority community.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing you say is that without the diversity amongst the community, we can't even expect them to work together, right? And I know that AFLV just happened, and I'm pretty sure, I wasn't there, but I'm pretty sure there were a whole bunch of conversations around like building a better community and enhancing Greek unity and all of this stuff. And I think what I'm hearing you say is one of the big starting points is actually to increase the diversity across the community. Because that way groups can talk to each other and they can interact with each other, and we decrease some of those, you know, biases that might exist because we're interacting with folks and having more of an open mind around different cultures and perspectives. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that, you know, if you're the only way that you encourage diversity between your chapters is through AFLV, you've obviously missed an opportunity to encourage them to work together in the spaces that they occupy more often than the one at AFLV. And so, but that also takes on behalf of the advisors and staff to, one, recognize maybe their own barriers in diversity and their own barriers in being inclusive. And so that really calls people to think about themselves and their own identity and to do that work before they expect students to do that work, and not where we're condemning students for not getting it right, and not where we're criticizing students for not thinking how we think or thinking the way that we feel they should, but really looking at the growth that students experience when we ourselves know our own identity in a way that we're able to help students on that journey as well.
Yeah, and you know, it sounds like the whole idea of professionals continuing to do that self-work. You know, once, just because we finish and we get our master's degree and get that first job doesn't necessarily mean that we have done everything, and continuing to reflect on who we are and what we come to the table with is really important, especially when we're interacting with really with anybody, because they feel and sense those biases that we have. So,
right, I completely agree.
Sticking a little bit, I guess, with this advisor trend, you've worked on both campuses and now you're at a headquarters. And, you know, I'm curious what you've seen as some barriers to our fraternal organizations, and I'm using that as the umbrella term for like Greek letter orgs, but barriers to fraternal organizations to becoming more diverse.
So I would definitely say politics. I think on any campus or any organization you work in, there's so many constituents that you need to answer to or get approved. I think that is definitely a barrier. I would probably say funding. In this day and age, the way things are being cut at universities, you can see that oftentimes, sometimes multicultural services or diversity inclusion services are sometimes cut. Now, there's a flip side where a lot of times those things can also be promoted by the institution and funded in ways that are beneficial to the education and learning of the students. I think that alumni that have a heavy influence can often be a barrier, and also sometimes the fear of pushing back. I think, you know, we always talk about challenge and support. We talk about all these different student development theories, but what we never really talk about is, like, what does it really mean to challenge? And what does it really mean to support? And people get caught up on semantics and words. And I understand language is important, as I said earlier. But I'm thinking about the way that sometimes we're so afraid to say something in a way that's going to help, you know, challenge a student or to help challenge a member, that we will rather not say it and just kind of let it go away. And it's kind of contradictory to the work that we do when we want students to hold people accountable and we want students to have these tough conversations, but us ourselves are unable to do it as well. whether it's with students or with other advisors or alumni or even campus professionals. And so oftentimes, you know, the fear of, you know, pushing too hard or the fear of challenging too much or even sometimes the fear of being wrong is a barrier. Like, this is about learning and growth. Like, we want these students to be in these organizations, and when they leave college, we want them to be better than what they came in. And if we're not challenging, if we're not supporting, if we're not holding alumni and undergraduates accountable, then we're not really doing what it is that needs to be done. And that's a huge barrier to our success and moving forward as a field and thinking about ways to ensure the safety of students and to ensure the inclusivity of our organization.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the advisors I've seen who have really good conversations with their students, and, you know, a student will say something that is insensitive or a microaggression, and the advisor actually having a real genuine conversation about that. And, you know, I think there's a not trick. Trick is the wrong word. There's a balance to having some of those confrontational conversations, right? Like, it's not just, mm-hmm. oh, you're wrong. It's, hey, let's have a conversation about this and really piece out what's going on here. When you were talking about kind of the advisor thing, it made me think of some of the stuff that happened at one of those, an SEC school a couple years ago where, you know, some of the women in the community were like, hey, we're ready to increase the diversity of our organizations. And the advisors basically said, hey, no, we don't want that. This is what you're going to do. And, you know, being the campus-based professional willing to say, hey, I'm standing with you students to continue to challenge to make your organizations more diverse and being that support system for them. And I think that's, you know, that's really crucial in doing that. And the other piece too is just equipping ourselves and our students to have those conversations. You know, I know that you do a bunch of various conversations around diversity and inclusion, and I'm sure that within those, you know, part of it's how do you actually have a confrontation? How do you have a conversation with someone when they, you know, say something that probably they shouldn't be saying? And, you know, making sure that our students and us are able to actually do that is probably super relevant in, you know, that tackling some of these barriers.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's difficult, you know, with the microaggression piece, that is a challenge. Yeah. You know, myself as an African-American woman, I can always remember people being like, oh, you're so articulate, as though, you know, the time that I've spent in school, college, graduate school, and my doctorate classwork didn't prepare me to speak well. But, you know, I never heard other students being told that. Especially other students who did not look like me. And so it got to a point as a young person where I had to say, you know what, all of these things that people say are compliments aren't really compliments, because it's, why would you not expect me to be articulate? Why would you not expect me to be put together? Why would you not expect these things of a college-age young woman? And so it gets to the point personally where you have to be secure in who you are, which is why the identity work is so important. So that when we work with students that are having these microaggressions or having, you know, these, you know, side or quick compliments or whatnot being said to them, that they are secure enough in who they are to challenge that person's perspective. You know, I think the piece of it that is hard, though, is that that gets very tiring. Right. It gets very tiring, you know, as an unaffiliated student, but then as a fraternity sorority member, having to have those conversations and even having those with people that you should be trusting as advisors or campus professionals or alumni and things like that only continue to make that situation that much worse, because these are people that I should be trusting. And so I think that advisors also have to know when we say those things or when those things are said to us, how we're also able to combat that too. If they're said about our students, you know, some of the things that are said about, you know, fraternity men and sorority women in ways that it takes away from who we are, and is often based in stereotypes and sometimes maybe based in something that they've read or heard or whatnot, but how we challenge back on those. And I think for students that deal with racism and sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, all of those things, it's important to empower them to let them know that, one, they have a place, that where they are is by no mistake, that they are exactly where they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be at that campus. They're not a number. They were not a, you know, an admission that was, that just slipped through the cracks, that they're exactly where they're supposed to be. And we have to, as advisors, whether you're on campus, whether you're a headquarters staff, whether you are an alumni advisor, really support students in helping them to develop that identity and that self-assurance, that they know when things are being said how to combat those and how to have the conversation in a way where it's challenging, but it's also firm in what they believe. And that's really important so that these students can continue to grow and to challenge, so that when something is said, that students are able to have a conversation about it to help educate, and if they hear something to read or some resource, so you're able to do that. And it's the same thing that we need to do as advisors when we are having conversations around difference. You know, I don't think that you can tell someone from a marginalized identity how they should feel about being marginalized. You know, I don't think it's an argument that if someone tells you that what you're saying is not appropriate or not right, it's take a step back and listen. Because this person lives with this identity every day and deserves the same respect that they get to you, the respect that you're able to get because of your identity, their privilege, or whatnot. And so the same way that we should do that as advisors respectfully, the same way we should do that as advisors to educate, and the same way we help our students to do that and to have those conversations with our students, you know, it's really about the education of it, so that you don't say it again, so that you understand why it's not appropriate, and so that when you make the choice to engaging conversation, that you're doing it in a way where you know that it's not to hurt or to harm, but it is truly to educate and to make things better and to help to provide resources and opportunities for growth.
Yeah, and it, you know, kind of the whole being corrected and learning and growing from those things makes me think about just really the great opportunity we do have in fraternities and sororities that, you know, one, I'm surrounded by a group of people who have pledged to support me. And so if they're going to challenge me on that, they're, you know, they should be doing it out of brotherly or sisterly love. And so it's something, right, being challenged by a friend, by a brother or sister is so much, it's a little more comforting or comfortable, I guess. Challenge is never comfortable, but it's a little less, rocky than being challenged by a complete stranger. And so having that happen within the context of fraternity and sorority can be really helpful in helping our membership grow. And then for those members who are facing microaggressions on a daily, sometimes hourly basis, being able to have a whole group of fraternity or sorority members behind them saying, hey, we agree with you, we've got your back, that this is not okay, can perhaps lessen, I don't know, because I'm not in that space, but perhaps can lessen some of the strain that going through that can be. I think, you know, we touched on some of these things already in this conversation, but approaching some of those barriers to diversity, certainly preparing ourselves to have those conversations and doing that self-work and being willing to kind of confront things that are happening. But what are some other ways to overcome the barriers that we've noted around fraternal organizations being diverse?
I think one of the things that I think that FAE has done well, specifically speaking, is diversity and inclusion can't just be, you know, a 30-minute workshop or a webinar. It's how do you use the idea of inclusivity throughout the work that you're doing. You know, if students only attend one speaker or they only see one piece of it, then they're not really getting it. But thinking about how does inclusivity apply to recruitment? How does it apply to making, you know, to leadership and to, you know, different areas of who your chapter is and how you lead your chapter. And so overcoming that barrier means making diversity inclusion such a priority that it's ingrained in all of the work that you do, that students see it in different ways, that they're taught about it when they think about their personal philosophy, that they're taught about it when they think about their leadership style, you know, that it's infused in recruitment, not just, you know, oh, talk to different people, but actually saying, what types of questions are you asking? And so by taking the idea of diversity inclusion and taking and putting it into practice across your education, that's one of the things that I think is a significant way to break the barriers and to also overcome some of the challenges, because students are seeing it in more ways than one, and they're able to then think about applying it, because it's one thing to teach someone something, but it's another thing for them to take it and to apply it to their practice. Mm-hmm. And that is, for me, the end goal, is that they're being able to take what they're learning and to put it into action. And so by putting it in different areas, by putting it in different curriculum, by showing it to them in different ways, that is how you get that. And that is how you overcome those barriers when it comes to this type of education and these challenging conversations.
Yeah, so we're essentially teaching a skill that we can use in a variety of situations. And the more situations we help students see it kind of pop up and see how it's relevant, the more able they're going to be to really apply that to any situation, even if they haven't been, quote unquote, trained within that situation. Mm-hmm. I love that, and I love that y'all are doing that with SAE. Mm-hmm. I think there might be some, and this is, you know, backing up a little bit in the conversation, but I think there are some in hopefully not really in our field, but I've heard this comment from different students I've worked with who might say that, you know, everyone just needs a space to just be with people like them. So who cares if my, you know, IFC fraternity isn't diverse? We've got an MGC, we've got NPHC, you know, let's just have that. And I would love to know how you might respond to that. You know, if you've heard that from a student or an advisor, or, a campus-based professional, what would you say?
So I believe that people will always have a space where they want to be with people who think similar to them. Even within their chapters, they'll have their friend groups, their cliques, all of those things. And so spaces are found and often sought out by people who want that. Mm-hmm. I do think that people join people that are interesting to them and that they connect with. You know, as Fired Up has told us, for years, people join people, and it's definitely true. Yeah. And so chapters have different cultures, and those are telling in the membership that they hold. You know, what is your chapter about? And so students aren't going to go where they feel uncomfortable or where they don't connect with people. And I think that we have to help chapters see that just because they don't think like you, just because they don't act like you, maybe they don't even look like you, that there's not anything that you can, that there's not a barrier to connecting with that person. Now, there are some people who are never going to click, and I get that. But I also think that we miss out on so many opportunities for growth and development and for bettering our chapters when we stick to a very cookie-cutter type member. And in doing that, we're limiting the opportunity that we have as a chapter, but we're also excluding people that could bring something good to us. And so I think that when groups are okay just recruiting from their friend groups or their high school groups, well, there might be some diverse, it's not really all that inclusive if the campus has so much more to offer. And so it's important for, you know, advisors and, you know, anyone that works at these groups to really push them outside of their comfort zone to talk to other people, just to introduce themselves. And even if that person never becomes a member, it's another connection that you've made that can speak positively on their experience with you as a member.
Yeah, so, I mean, similar to some of the stuff we've already talked about, right, that, you know, it's important to make sure that you are, even if no one but folks from your high school join your chapter, and that would be really a really interesting recruitment strategy. But, you know, make sure that you are an opening and welcoming organization so that anyone could, if they wanted to, join and feel welcome there. And I love that last point that you made, that, you know, it doesn't matter if someone can join or chooses to join your organization, because you've made a friend, you've made a relationship, and that's really, you know, it's not about building the numbers of our chapters. And that's something I regret from my undergrad days, is, you know, looking and seeing, you know, men in student senate and thinking, oh, hey, I wonder if they can join my fraternity. And then, oh, they're already affiliated. Well, I'm just not going to talk to them. But instead looking at everybody as an opportunity to develop a relationship and then learn from them, regardless of that. I think, you know, we need to get out of that recruitment business and get into the relationship business, as, you know, Fired Up has taught you and me and so many other folks. So, I'd love to spend the last part of our conversation talking about the work that you've been doing specifically. You know, a whole bunch of folks, when I said, hey, what do we want to hear about on the FSL podcast? A whole bunch of people were like, Ashley Canty, we want to know what she's doing and the stuff that she's been doing with diversity and inclusion with SAE, because it's great and we hear it's great, but we want to know what's going on. And so I'd love to know kind of what that process has looked like for you, approaches you've been taking that you've seen positive results with. And so, you know, share with us and all the folks who are really supportive and encouraging, even if you haven't heard it, they're all just rooting for you.
Well, that's good to know. So I've been with SAE for about a year and a half now, and at this point in my career, I don't think I could have made a better move. I am very pleased with the work that's been done. I'm very happy with the people that I've worked with, and while we know that change takes time, I am very positive in saying that SAE is doing what it takes to make the changes that need to happen. And so I think that the staff that I am very fortunate enough to work with is very supportive of the work that I do, but in also working together to think about how can we do things better. You know, we're always we're having conversations about what's next, what needs to change, what do we need to talk about. And I think that's important. You know, a lot of people saw what happened with the Oklahoma situation, and then, you know, I think some people thought, like, oh, nothing is going on. But I know for a fact that, you know, we still have those conversations. We're still thinking about what more needs to be done. And while every day is not perfect in the world of SAE, every day there's an effort being made to make that experience better. And so one of the things that I enjoy most and that we've been able to do in the work is really bringing together different departments to look at what it is that we need to do. So my job is housed in our health and safety department. So it's myself, general counsel, director of chapter development, and associate executive director for chapter development. And so with my position, I work with the bias-related incidents, sexual assault prevention education. I work with our assessment and also our service and philanthropy programs. And so working with our director of educational programs, we were able to look at the diversity and inclusion, you know, position statements and my position and say, okay, how do we use this in all of our programs? And so James Irwin has done a really good job of putting, not making diversity and inclusion just a breakout session, but it's infused in everything that we do. And he's created, you know, a group of alumni that have helped to write the curriculum, and they value that as well. Recently, we last year for the first year, we had non-members facilitate leadership school. And so in thinking about diversity and inclusion, you know, people need to be exposed to different people. You know, these young men need to see other non-members who are supportive of them, other men, other women, people of color, our LGBT, you know, friends and family. Like, they need to see these people in front of them in these roles that can, so that they know that their support system doesn't always have to look like them, yeah. Or that their support system doesn't have to be from their chapter, that their support system doesn't even have to be a member of SAE. And so we've been able to do that. We've also started looking at you know, different ways to do education, doing it through webinars and modules and in person. And so we've done a lot of assessment looking at our programs, so seeing what is effective, what are students getting on campus, and then using that information to think about what needs to look different in our roles as education. And so for my position, I do travel to campuses. Some campuses, maybe they've had an incident, but sometimes it's being proactive, looking at campus culture, what's going on, and I go visit a chapter. And so when I visit the chapter, I meet with the executive board, I meet with the service and philanthropy officers, and then I also meet with the chapter president, and I'll meet with the campus advisor. Recently this year, I started meeting with any type of cultural staff, LGBTQ resource staff, Women's Center, Title IX office, because I think that one of the missed opportunities in fraternity sorority advising is that we don't often connect with our campus partners in ways that help us. I can't be there all the time. So if there's an incident that happens or a chapter needs an educational program, or maybe we need someone to look at some curriculum, so building these relationships with campus professionals that are also doing the work. And so I think that's really important to have. We've also looked at, the different ways that we can educate our members. So whether it's through webinars, looking at, you know, different people on staff doing different types of webinars, we want to make sure that we're not just being preventative and the different way that we tell students not to do things, but that we're also focusing on the holistic development of these young men. What else does the fraternity need to provide in terms of education to make their experience better? So whether it's about event planning, resume review, healthy relationships, like, we want to make sure that we're providing that to them and in support of what campuses are doing. And so we've done a really good job of doing that, and I will be able to do a few webinars as well, and to do that work of looking at different ways to educate. We've really taken a big leap on assessment to really make sure that not only are programs intentional, but that they're also impactful. So we've been doing pre and post surveys. I've worked closely with our director of educational programs, and we want to look at what are the workshops that work best, what are some areas in the curriculum that are good, and so it's the continual updating of what's going on so that we know what we are doing. And then even having our service project at every national program, and that's really important because that's where we're able to have those conversations about marginality, privilege, and identity, and where we're able to work with young men to say, we've met a need in a community. So it's not just let's give cans to the food bank, it's let's call the food bank and ask them what they need. Let's be intentional in meeting a need, but also let's think about the privilege that we have as college students and as members of a group organization where we can go into communities and make something better, because that is what we are charged to do, and tie it back in to privilege and identity and diversity and inclusion so that these men have an understanding of what it looks like in the community around them and not just this very overview and broad perspective. A lot of our programs, we are talking about privilege and we're talking about identity. We're talking about the multiple identity development model in a way when we talk about that everyone comes from these backgrounds, that privilege isn't just one type of way. There may be several types of privilege. There's also several types of ways that people can be marginalized. And how do we use the privilege in the area that we have to advocate for those around us and in the world? And how do we give back to the community to make them a better place? And so, and the work that I'm doing, whether it's education, whether it's assessments, whether it's, health and safety and risk reduction, as we talk about sexual assault education, I believe that we're continuing to have conversation to think about what's next, what can we do better. We're continuing to look at education not just as a one-stop shop, but as something that we infuse throughout our programs on the national level and even on the regional and the state level, being able to go to the different leadership conferences and expose students to these conversations and to also have them with those students there. And I think that my campus visits, the visits that I do to these different leadership conferences, the work that I'm able to do with the staff has definitely helped us to be more aware of what needs to be done, but to also help train advisors and students to be able to push back and challenge. And when things do not go as we plan them, then we're definitely able to handle the situation in a way where we are effective, but also so that we are intentional and we are quick so that we make sure that situations don't linger, but that we're able to address it and make sure that things are better and that the men are better and that we do hold them accountable and to a high standard.
Awesome. Well, there's so much there that is just absolutely incredible and hard to point out, like, here are some of the different things, but like one of the things that stands out is just the intentionality that you have woven throughout everything and the strategy that you're taking, starting with the different assessments and the pre and post test, but also just the needs assessment for the students to say, what do you need? What do you need to learn? How can we, meet that? But then also thinking about, well, what are those areas that we need to continue to provide you education in as we see it from a national level? And then the other piece that I really love that you talked about is just that partnership, that you take time to go and meet with not just the campus professionals, but other individuals on the student affairs or wherever, some of the diversity and inclusion initiatives are housed at the university level, that you go and meet with them. And I think, one of the first, I'd say, quote unquote, homework for our listeners is to make sure that they know who those folks are on their campus and that they can reach out to them and have conversations and build those relationships. Because I think we operate in a vacuum or in a silo a lot of times and really don't reach out to folks who know way more than we do and can have much better conversations than we can have and can help us to have better conversations. than we can by ourselves, just sitting, you know, in our offices in the Fraternity Sorority Life Suite or wherever we are. And then I love how you're including, you know, diverse perspectives with SAE programming too, that, you know, students can see that it's not just their own folks who care about them, but it's people from all over the fraternity sorority landscape, and perhaps even not in the fraternity sorority landscape, that want them to succeed and be better folks, because that's teaching them diversity, but in just a totally different way. And so, you know, you're weaving it all throughout. And so I know I'm rooting for you and everyone's, for you and your success. And I know there's lots of folks who are. And so I'm thankful just for what you've done so far and continue to do with your team there at SAE.
Yes, thank you. Yes, it's definitely been a interesting journey, but it's been a good one, and I could not be in a better place professionally to do this type of work.
Yeah, well, I want to wrap up by asking you to help our listeners continue to do some self-work and some self-education, because I know, you know, this is a good opportunity to start that conversation. And one of the things I hope that these podcast episodes do is to inspire further curiosity for folks. And so as folks mm-hmm. think about learning more, and so they're not like calling you and emailing you constantly being like, Ashley, explain this to me. You know, what are some other places, things folks should be reading, listening to, following? I know one of the things I've really enjoyed, and this is actually kind of about you, but I've enjoyed watching all of your different tweets this month about mm-hmm. things that have happened each day around Black history. And I had no clue some of the really cool different historical events and births and inventions and whatnot that happened just in the month of February. I'm like, oh, I kind of wish you'd do this throughout the entire year. But I know that that's a lot of work. So, you know, back to that original question, like, what are resources for folks who want to continue this mm-hmm. conversation and continue to be curious?
So some of the people that I read, especially when talking about microaggressions, is Darryl Sue. He's done a lot of work around racial and gender microaggressions. He's looked at student organizations. And a lot of his work deals with college students and, like, the impact and what it means for microaggression. And it's racial, gender, socioeconomic, all of those different ways that sometimes comments are made and, you know, the continuation of those and what that means for students. George Kuhn does a lot of work around deep impact activities, and this is a lot of stuff from grad school, but really looking at George Kuhn's work as you think about how to have those challenging conversations so that there's an impact there. Dr. Sean Harper, Dr. Lori Patton, Dr. Walter Kimbrough, and Dr. Mary Howard Hamilton, they are all doing a lot of work around like NPHC or, you know, Greek life as it relates to students of color. Mm-hmm. And so they do a lot of work from the perspective of student development and NPHC organizations. What does it mean? What does it look like? And how do we really help support that experience? I listen to a few podcasts. I really like This American Life, as it talks about social inequities and marginalization in different communities. I think that, you know, bigger than what is happening on our campuses is what's happening in our communities and how we engage students about that. Thinking about critical race theory, it's a legal term, but in the sense of critical race theory and how are our institutions set up, what are our policies, what are the policies of our organization that can sometimes be a deterrent, not just about race, but it could be class, it could be gender, it could be sexuality. So thinking about how those all play together to really form the experience that students are having. You know, there's been a lot of work around microaggressions. You know, there's been also some really good work. NASPA Journal had an article out about safe spaces, about what that really means and what that looks like for students and challenging like notions of racism and sexism, classism, and all of those things. We're really looking at what that means. I think also reading on identity. So a lot of us are very familiar with identity development models. And so as I've done my own reading, one of the things that you should think about with identity development models is the lack of students of color that participated in those programs. So a lot of our student development models are often based off of the majority perspective or identity. And so using that as your end-all and be-all can sometimes be to the detriment of your work, often because it doesn't include voices of those who are marginalized. And so we need to be conscious of that and applying it, you know, even looking at Cross's theory in the sense that it is written from the acceptance of blackness, meaning that being black is something that's wrong. And so if that is the only theory that you use in relation to advising black students, you may want to think about that a little differently. There's some really good work about African self-consciousness and the ways that African-American students sometimes negotiate the idea of blackness. Also, in looking at code switching often refers to students of color, but it's also important when you think of code switching to think about the ways in which our students participate in groupthink and code switching in the sense of how exhausting it can be to be one way, but then to be able, you know, to so that you are not the stereotype. I think all of those are really important, understanding the work that we do the complexity of identity and students mm-hmm. that we're working with. We're not working with the same students, and while we want to be fair and equal, we also need to think about equity in the sense we need to give everybody not just what they need, but everybody what they need that fits. And so we're able to better serve students. And so those are some of the things that I read, topics I look at. And I'm more than happy if people want to email me or send me anything on Instagram or Twitter, any of those social media networks. I'm more than happy to assist people with finding resources or getting them to something that can be beneficial to their own learning and development as well.
Wonderful. Well, and I will work to compile all of those and include them in our show notes too. And they'll be on the blog as, like, you know, links for people to look at and say, hey, here's this stuff. But Ashley, I want to thank you for joining me a second time. It all recorded this time. But thank you for joining me and for sharing kind of all of your thoughts and knowledge and helping to challenge professionals to think differently and think better about the work that we're doing. And I wish you all the best of luck as you continue with your work within SAE and just within the entire fraternal movement. So thank you for what you're doing, and thanks for lending your voice to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm really excited to see what comes out of this. So thanks so much. And again, thank you so much for the support. I definitely appreciate it.
And that's our show for the week. I hope these conversations continue to inspire curiosity within you and your colleagues as you discuss them. If you have comments or questions or ideas for future shows, tweet at me, @MattDeeg, or leave a comment on iTunes or on the blog. As always, stay curious.